All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We have a packed show for you today. It's one that I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time introducing other than to let you know who's going to be on. At the back end of the show, we'll be hearing from Sansara Taylor, and it's a pre-recorded message she did that's talking about the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride down in Texas. It's happening right now. It just kicked off, and we're going to be hearing from Sansara on a regular basis over the next few weeks. So that's at the back end of the show. You'll be hearing all about that. Before that, we'll be listening to an interview I did with the director of a brand new film called Alive Inside. It's a very moving, very powerful film about how people, as they age and get sick, are just completely tossed aside in this society, left to rot, to retreat, to disappear. And yet, it doesn't have to be this way. And this is an amazing, amazing film showing the effect of music and caring on bringing people back into society and back into connection with other humans. But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Alan Goodman. Alan's a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and he has been covering for the last few years Israel, the role of Israel in the world, the role of Israel in the U.S. in the world, and especially in relation to the oppression and assaults on the Palestinian people that have been commonplace and increasingly more vicious over the last few years. Well, I'm very pleased to welcome to the show today Alan Goodman. Alan, how are you?
Michael, I'm angry, and I'm here.
Yeah, good, good. The Israelis, the attacks on civilians continue just unmitigated, and it poses huge questions for people right now. I think it's really, as I was saying earlier, I interviewed a man from Gaza last week, and as his horror and anger grew throughout the course of the interview, he kept just almost tearfully demanding to know, where is the world? Why is no one doing anything about this? Why is no one seeing what's really happening here? Let's just kick that around a little bit for the beginning.
First of all, some people are doing some things about it, and it's important that we recognize that and have their backs. I don't know if your listeners have heard about this, but a number of very prominent Spanish actors, including Javier Bardem, Penelope Cruz, and Pedro Almodovar, the director, issued a strong statement condemning what's going on with Israel's assault on Gaza. And, you know, we should know to beginning, but important statements even made by people who are pro-Israel, but for whom these crimes are just off the charts, including some veterans of the Israeli military. And you had sent me an editorial by, a supporter of Israel who is really saying that this has gone too far. So on the one hand, when people say nobody's doing anything, I think we have to speak about what people are doing, but then we also have to speak about sometimes when people say that they're expecting something better from, say, Obama or, the UN or forces who they expect should be speaking out in the context of this, this horrible outrage. I'm looking now for this quote that I want to share from the White House press secretary. Now, I was listening to the show before yours that was, identifying some of the horrors going on in Gaza, but you have a situation where almost 2 million people have been locked down for going on 8 years now. Food and water almost cut off. 95% of the tap water in Gaza was undrinkable before this horrific slaughter started. People do not have access to the basic necessities of life. Now, electricity is off, and in an area as densely populated as New York City, the electricity was taken out by Israeli bombs. I mean, this is really a collective massacre of civilians. And then you had an Israeli attack on a UN school. And then you had another Israeli attack on a UN school. And then you had the Israeli attack on the UN school where desperate people had taken refuge in Beit Hanun on July 24th, and we're standing in the courtyard of the school in open air. So, don't give us any of this stuff about how they were hiding missiles under their jackets or something. They were standing in a courtyard. You can see this in video. We've got a link to the video at revcom.us, where you can see this courtyard. It's like a parking lot. People are completely exposed. And on July 24th, what was it, 16 people and 100 injured, women and children and families who had taken refuge in a UN school. And then, what was it, 2 days ago, you had yet another Israeli attack on desperate people gathered at a UN school, and where 19 people were killed. And here's where I want to speak to the other side of what you were citing, where people are saying, why isn't anybody doing anything about this? Here, let me just read from the statement. The United States White House, Barack Obama's press secretary: the shelling of a UN facility that is housing innocent civilians who are fleeing violence is totally unacceptable and indefensible, he said. And then he said, we need our allies in Israel to do more to live up to the high standards they have set for themselves. And then he further expanded on that and saying that the Israelis should live up to the standards they have set for their own military operations to protect the lives of innocent civilians. Well, the standards that the Israeli military has set for protecting the lives of innocent civilians is that absolutely anybody, anywhere, doing anything or doing nothing in Gaza is a target. So then the next question is, and as they were pointing out in the show that was on right before yours, in the midst of all this horror, this wanton massacre of majority civilians, the U.S. is shipping more tank missiles over to Israel to continue the slaughter and presenting Israel as the victim in all this, the ones under attack. You know, maybe we'll get a chance to talk about the role of the media in all this. And that really poses the question of what is behind the U.S. backing for Israel, which I think you probably want to get into. But I'm just kind of responding to this question of nobody's doing anything. The global powers that be are aiding, abetting, enabling, and sponsoring this massacre. People are beginning to speak out and need to be supported when they do. Anyway, we can...
Yeah, definitely. And we will. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Alan Goodman, writer for Revolution Newspaper. And we're talking about Israel's genocidal assault against the Palestinian people, which is now into its fourth week. I do want to visit this thing about the role of the U.S., because this is one of the questions that has come up a lot in people I've been speaking with, including the Palestinian I interviewed last Friday, who also made the point that, you know, he was talking about what he saw when the Senate 100-0 said, okay, we're going to support this. There's all these things that are coming out where it's a constant reference to, you know, the sort of, and again, it's part of the media, but it's also what the government is saying, where, you know, the idea when the Obama administration comes out and says, this is not good that they're doing this. On the other hand, you do have to recognize we have to begin with, Israel has the right to defend itself. This man was pointing out that it's not just a question of complicity, that in his mind, it's also almost to him, it's like, it's green lighting. And he made the point that you have the fourth largest military in the world, and everything that they use, all the weapons they use in their genocidal attacks are supplied or furnished or refurbished by the U.S. And I wanted to ask you about this, because it is something that you've written about a lot about this. You've written about both what's behind this, as well as the history of this, of a very special relationship between Israel and the U.S.
Right. There's no way of evading it now. When you hear a statement like that, first of all, the first three Israeli bombings of schoolyards and all these other horrific crimes have been justified by the White House and the mainstream media, including the New York Times, all framed in the context of Israel under attack from ineffective rockets from Gaza and, you know, just distorting the whole situation. We've got a piece at RevCom that I wrote that just walks through a whole series of incidents, and I can't go into them all here, but some of your listeners might be familiar with these. Diane Sawyer ran a piece supposedly showing devastation in Gaza, in Israel, rather. The film footage was from Gaza. And then the next day there was a correction issued, but the damage was done. And there's a whole series of these kinds of things, as well as lies by omission, lies by distortion. We ran a pick cap of a New York Times headline, First Israeli Dies. Well, this was on a day when dozens of Palestinians had died. And people are being conditioned who read the Times to see Palestinian lives as valueless, essentially. So there's this whole distortion of things. And then there is this 100-0 vote you noted in the Senate and so on. And I know this poses a question for people, including, you know, I think some of this is prompted by some of the very, very contextualized criticisms of Israel from the White House, like the one I just read, where, okay, you know, you bombed a few too many school courtyards with children and innocent civilians in them, but of course you're the good guys in all this. And this does pose for people, what is the nature of the whole historic special relationship? And this is something that we've written about extensively at RevCom, including in a special issue on Israel that people can find at RevCom.us. But just in a nutshell, historically, Israel is a product of, you know, it's built on ethnic cleansing, and it's a product of imperialism as an outpost for imperialism in the Middle East. And that's part of what goes into this provocative quote from Bob Avakian that I've encouraged people to think seriously about when he said, after the Holocaust, the worst thing that has happened to Jewish people is the state of Israel. So there's a question of where did Israel come from? What's its nature? What's its role in the world? And right now, there's a whole complicated swirl of things going on in the Middle East. And as the rulers of the United States bully their way through these shifting alliances and instability and so on, Syria, Egypt, and beyond, they're backing Israel as their most reliable ally in the whole region. The rise of the U.S. empire after World War II and everything since has been dependent in important ways on that special relationship of their enforcer Israel in the Middle East. That, in a nutshell, is what's driving this.
Now, let's talk about this. You mentioned earlier about the press, and I want to dig a little bit more deeply into the press because they have been really pushing, I mean, a whole way, a whole perspective on this, which basically, I mean, everything from convincing people that it's a complicated issue, that you really have to understand that there's two wrongs going on there. One's more wrong than the other, but there's two. They're even-handed. Each one's, you know, responsible for a certain amount of suffering, and it's a mess. And really, you know, I don't know how to sort this out. The press has been doing that at the same time, all the time. The ways I mean, also I was telling you last night, I looked at the LA Times yesterday, and they had an article about, you know, some horrendous thing that happened in Gaza, and then in the middle of it, they had a picture of a mortuary with three kids in it, and the caption read that it was, you know, Palestinian kids in a mortuary, but then the whole article, big center page article, was on Israel, and how Israel is worried about, you know, the impact of all this on them, and how are they going to deal with all this thing, and the question becomes, here's a force in the world that's committing. You know, when you're talking about what the Zionists are doing, they are committing, you know, as Ilan Pappe called it, incremental genocide. They're committing war crimes beyond question, crimes against humanity. And yet the U.S. press is just going overboard portraying this as, well, you know, you really can't tell who's doing what to who here. Can you talk about that a little? Because it has implications for everything else we've been talking about.
Well, I think there's a lot of dimensions to it. And one of them is just portraying a one-sided massacre by a country built on ethnic cleansing against the victims of that ethnic cleansing as, like you say, a two-sided conflict started by Hamas. But I think there's an ideological dimension to it or a moral dimension to it as well that kind of underlies one of the examples you're bringing up, which is that, and it kind of gets to that New York Times headline I was talking about. It's one is first Israeli dies, and then, you know, 16 paragraphs down, oh, by the way, 80 Palestinians died today, and it kind of reminds me of back when the Onion newspaper was coming out in print and they had a massive headline, one American dies, and then, you know, 12 paragraphs down, Japan sinks, you know, to the bottom of the ocean and 200 million people died. But never mind that. One of them was an American. And this is the way people are trained to think in America. And by extension, you know, Israelis are like us. They believe in the same values we do. They're civilized people, and there's even racist connotations and dimensions to this. But more fundamentally, these are people who are part of the civilized world. Well, again, the shared values between the United States and Israel include that they're both built on genocide and ethnic cleansings. But people are trained that we have these special high moral values and that we share them with the Israelis. So Israeli lives are kind of an extension of American lives. And in opposition to that, you know, at RevCom and other people have brought this forward as well, and it's an important stand to popularize, and I encourage people to tweet it and so on. American lives are not more important than other people's lives. And it's time for people to stop thinking like Americans and start thinking about humanity.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking with Alan Goodman, writer for Revolution Newspaper. And we're talking about Israel's genocidal assault against the Palestinian people, which is now into its fourth week. Let me ask you this. You commented in one of the things you wrote that Ilan Pappé's analysis that what Israel is doing in Gaza is part of an incremental genocide, that that's a very critical insight. Why?
Well, because it's true. I mean, he, you know, in the interview that you did with him, he goes into depth about how it's important for people to stop looking at things in terms of what's the current conflict provoked by Hamas rockets, and then before that it was showing from Lebanon, and before that it was something else, and to recognize a pattern here of incremental genocide. And now, when we are hearing the Israelis say that they're not going to stop the slaughter in Gaza until, and I don't have, you know, the wording right in front of me, but a lot of formulations along the lines of until we resolve the problem once and for all, there are ominous echoes of Hitler's rhetoric around a final solution. I mean, the whole logic and immorality of what's being argued by Israel and its backers in the halls of power in the United States is that the Palestinians are the problem and that there has to be a final solution, or so far, I think their PR people will probably, to the extent one of them blurts out final solution, might point out that's a little, can't you come up with another wording? But there are ominous echoes of that, both in what they're doing. I mean, this is a sealed off small area, again, as densely populated, I'm talking about Gaza, as densely populated as New York City, water cut off. Israel bombed the electricity. This is not an area of the world where people can live very long without electricity. You know, it's been choking off food and construction supplies for years, and now is created an atmosphere where something like, and I don't have the exact statistics in front of me, but something like 50% of the population are refugees. Well over 100,000 gathered at UN facilities where they should be able to seek shelter and safety, and instead they're essentially sitting ducks for Israeli missiles. Ilan Pappé's observation is critical because it's true and it's important. Other people are recognizing this, and it's important that people speak out. And that when they do speak out, we have their backs, because celebrities and others who speak out around this come under vicious attack, and we have to make sure that they're not silenced.
All right, Alan, we're going to have to wrap this up, but I want to know if you have any closing comments you want to make.
Well, I'll share something that's, I was going to say off the record, but we're on the air, but I'll share something that I don't have the wording in front of me, but a reader of RevCom.us sent in something along the lines of, from Gaza to the U.S.-Mexico border to the ghetto, people must be free. We need revolution. And I think that is kind of the take-home message from what we're seeing now.
All right, Alan, thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll have you back again soon.
Okay, thanks, Juan. Right. Take care.
Bye. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Alan Goodman, a writer for Revolution Newspaper, and we've been talking about Israel's genocidal attack against the Palestinian people, which is deep into its fourth week now. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be listening to a conversation I had with the director of a new film called Alive Inside, all right? So stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Babatunde Lia, and it was from his Sweet Unseen album, and it's called Sweet Unseen, Ancestral Stroll. Check this out. It's a really beautiful album, really beautiful song. All right, we're now going to be listening to a conversation I had with Michael Rosato Bennett, and Michael is the director of a brand new film called Alive Inside, And Live Inside is opening up all over the country over the next couple of weeks. So wherever you are, get a chance to look at it. It's also going to be available on a lot of different places. I'm sure it'll be on Netflix. You can probably look for it on iTunes, all these things. Don't miss the film, though. Whenever you get a chance to see it, grab that chance and check it out. And it's a film that I did actually had the chance to see very recently. I heard about it up at Sundance when I was there. It's an amazing film, a really, really moving and very, very enlightening film. So without any further ado, here's my conversation that happened just about a week ago with Michael Rosato Bennett. When I went to Sundance this year, a friend of mine was there with me and saw a film that really knocked her out of her seat. She came back and she said, "You got to see this film." And she said, "I was crying about it. I was all this." And I said, "Yeah, but you're just a crybaby." And then she said, "Go watch the film." And she told me that she had spoken with the director of the film, and she was suggesting that I really seriously watch the film and talk with the director. So I did. And I have to say, as she predicted, I was also a puddle of tears many parts in the film. And I really wanted to talk with the director of the film. The film is called Alive Inside, and the director is Michael Rosato Bennett.
Yes, but I mean, I don't think this is a sad film.
You talk about tears,
but, you know, it was an amazing experience. First of all, I never expected anyone to see this film. I made it in my bedroom. I live in the East Village of New York. I had two guys in my bedroom. My wife was about to divorce me. Okay. And I wasn't even going to submit it to Sundance because it was $100 and I was dead broke. And I was like, they're never going to want to see a film about music and the mind and elders and dementia. And my wife literally made me submit it on the very last moment. She literally said, like, you know, I think the 34th Street post office is open till midnight. Let's go. And I was like, no. And she said, we'll take the car. And I was like, we'll lose our spot. No way. You know, anyway, and I literally made it through that door of those big bronze doors as the very last moment that they were open. And then at Sundance, I got to experience, you know, Sundance is unlike other film festivals. It goes on for like a week. So a film that has a deep emotional core can actually build, unlike every other showing of films in this country, where, you know, you just go in for a moment or you download it and then you go eat something and you download another movie, you know? At Sundance, people's hearts can get engaged in something.
Well, that's what I meant by the tears, actually, because It wasn't tears of like, oh, I'm so sad. But it was like you actually, in your film, you capture something that is very rare in the world today. It's very rare in the interpersonal relationships between people. It's rare on what you get as entertainment. It's rare anywhere.
What is that rareness?
To me, what it was I was very deeply moved by these people, people that were the main subjects of your film, the people that have Alzheimer's, and people that actually had spent many years just basically closed up.
Right.
And their ability to even have the essential human experience. Not even, you know, you can grant it, people can be ill, they can be whatever, but they were robbed of the essential human connection. And when you saw that, when you saw that come to life, if you didn't tear up, there's really, I wouldn't want to know you, okay?
But
that's what it was.
I mean, you really hit it on the head there. You know, I think that's what moves people about this film is that they feel in their own lives, in their own hearts, that there's something missing. There's some kind of disconnection that our culture is in right now. These people are the most disconnected human beings on the planet. Their bloodstreams have more drugs in them than any other population on the planet Earth. These are our elders. These are our grandparents, and they live in the American nursing home, sometimes for 10 years before they die. And I did not intend to make this film.
Before you get into that, we should tell people again, the film is Alive Inside, and now tell them what it's about.
What this film is about music, like this deepest human wisdom that we have. And its capacity to go into the being, into the emotion, into the mind, and especially into the mind of those poor souls on our planet. Right now, there's 5 million people in this country with Alzheimer's dementia. That's a huge number. That number is going to double in the next 15 years in this country. And everyone is, you know, I know, everyone is 1 degree of separation away from somebody who's going through this. And It is our greatest nightmare, the idea that you could lose your mind, you could lose your memory, you could lose who you were. And I didn't intend to make this film. I was kind of like on a job I was sort of doing to help somebody to make a couple bucks. And I walked into this nursing home and I saw like lining, literally lining the hallways in wheelchairs, hundreds of people just kind of parked there. Some of them for as much as a decade and gone. One of the people I interviewed in the film says, she calls them living dead people. She says, when you are treated like an object long enough, you just disappear. At first you go into yourself and you try and make an inner life, but that you can't hold that for long. I mean, she calls it solitary confinement. That's the life these people were living. And when I went into the nursing home, I wanted to run. I didn't want to be there, but it was a job. I was filming something. I was following this guy named Dan Cohen, and the job was to build a website for him with a whole bunch of films on it. The Shelley and Donald Rubin Foundation had hired me, and they were funding him to do this, you know, good deed, basically, to bring people with dementia the music that had stirred them when they were young, in their childhood. And the first person I saw was this 94-year-old man named Henry. And you know, Dan put music on Henry, and Henry was literally slumped over, like he couldn't even recognize his daughter.
And he had been that way for like, what, 10 years?
Eight years, I think, yeah. You know, and then I witnessed with my cameras and with my body and my heart, and, you know, I witnessed this something start to like just kind of like percolate inside of his brain. And I saw sort of him become like resurrected. I saw a human being bloom out of this shell where he had been living. Like the cloud of his dementia parted for a moment. And the being that came out was so beautiful. He was a singer and a poet. And it literally sent chills down my body. Because when you see another person come to life, what do you ask yourself? You go, oh, am I alive? Is there more inside of me than I know? Could I be awakened, you know? And it's true. We're all, I think all of us, are living these sort of lives that are suffering from sort of institutional treatment, if you will. Even our freedom is a sort of institutional freedom on the outside. But the real people that are suffering are those who live every day in these institutions. And you know, there's a million people in these institutions, and half of them get zero visitors.
And there'll probably be twice as many in a short period of time.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Michael Rosato Bennett. And Michael is the director of the film Alive Inside, a brand new film about the impact of music on bringing those who are afflicted with dementia and many other illnesses back into the world. All right? Tell me this. You mentioned Dan Cohen gave music to people.
Right.
I want to explore that a little bit because, mm-hmm. one, when you say gave music to people, what he did actually was he had iPods and
right.
he had a playlist that he got from either their family or whatever. However, whatever way he could get it, he got a playlist of music that these people loved at one point in their
life. And
that's
the essential thing. I like to play this game with people. I mean, we could do it with your listeners, you know. Close your eyes just right now for 2 seconds. Just close them. Go inside, and now you're 15, 16, 17 years old, and what I want you to do is imagine yourself listening to a song when you were that age. Can you do it? Do you have something
sure.
come to you?
Sure.
Okay, so here's the interesting thing. So you're probably actually hearing it in your head right now, like you're actually hearing that song. If you even look a little deeper inside of your imagination or wherever you are right at that moment, you're there, and you're not you. You've got you don't look like you. You are 15 or 16. You are that being. And it lives inside of your brain and inside of your heart. Inside that music are memories that are literally can be evoked in a moment. Haven't you ever had a song just kind of like, whoa, I'm back, you know?
I live in music, okay? I have many, many songs like that.
What song does that for you?
Well, you know, the one when you asked me to think about one, okay? What Becomes of the Brokenhearted?
Oh, my God. What a song.
There you go.
What a song. And kids today don't even know that song. Think like, what are kids doing today with their music? You know, think about it. All music is auto-tuned right now. Almost all of it. My brother's who wrote the soundtrack to Alive Inside. He wrote Smooth for Santana. His name's Ital Shore. He records music all the time. And now singers will come into the studio. They'll lay down their track and it won't be right. And they'll go, oh, don't worry about it. Just auto-tune it. Like even singers are giving up their voice to a computer. What else is in modern music? First of all, everything is computer generated. Almost 99% of the instruments, all the beats, you know, and they're all quantitized. So it's like children are saying, oh, this is my music. And you remember what music was for you, right?
Mm-hmm.
What if your music was the music of a robot? You know, what would that mean for your heart and soul? You know, my big dream here in this whole thing is I want to create connection. Okay, that's why I made this film. Because connection is the thing that is missing in the way we're living our lives. People are fools. Forgive me, but they don't really even investigate the connection of their own selves.
But there's something else that goes on. First, I want to remind people that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Michael Rosato Bennett, and we're talking about his film, Alive Inside, which tells the story of people who have been disconnected from basically the world for quite some time through dementia, Alzheimer's, other diseases as well, and for whom an iPod with a playlist has reconnected them to life, basically, in a deeper sense.
And the music, though, the music on that playlist
is
deeply personal music, right. And that is the key.
Now, let me ask you this. When you're presenting this, it's not just a thing of the mystical power of music, but there was a scientific basis to this, as I understood
absolutely.
As well.
Okay, so first of all, you know, Dan is a wonderful guy, but he didn't invent this. He doesn't claim to have invented anything. Music therapists have been analyzing and studying music for about 60 years now. There's just phenomenal data. Basically, what happens to human beings is, in dementia, what happens is the brain sort of erases from front to back. But there are certain things that are actually spared almost to the very end. And what those things are is, one of the things is the ability to experience music, to feel music, to understand music. That stays with us almost to the end. Our emotional system is almost completely intact. Actually, our movement systems, and by movement systems, I mean like even dancing. And so one of the amazing things for me in this whole journey was that learning that these people are not dead, they are not worthy of being discarded, that actually they are capable of experiencing the very thing that I think it makes me the most profound. In other words, the most profound thing I do is listen to my music. And they have the capacity to do that as well. And that's kind of staggering in how much my thinking changed. And I learned that in many of them, like this one woman, Mary Lou, came up to me after one day. We gave her music. I mean, she was, you have to see the film. Mary Lou has so much trouble navigating life. And when I gave her the Beach Boys, you know, it was like all of her struggles disappeared. And she was suddenly in a world that she could navigate perfectly. And she was so grateful after it was over, she came up and hugged me. And when she hugged me, it blew me away. Because here's a person that can barely navigate life. But when it comes to her physical, emotional parts, she is powerful. Like, she hugged me and I felt her love. It just poured into me without any barrier. And I don't get that from normal people. And if you've ever worked with people with like Down syndrome, you know, you'll find the exact same thing. Some of those kids that I've interacted with will chill you to the bone by the purity of their love. So we are not what we think we are. You know, we're not our thinking mind. I mean, it is part of us, you know, but there is another part of us. There's this entire emotional and kinesthetic system that is almost a separate intelligence, and it stays in us, and it is in these people, and that's what we're waking up when we give them music, because we're giving them personal music, and this personal music wakes their emotions, and when the emotions are awakened, it creates all these neurological pathways that are in there, sort of forgotten, but they can be awakened, and it's an important thing to know.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also included Dr. Oliver Sacks in this film.
Dr. Sacks is amazing.
Love his work, man. Love his work. Let's talk about him a little bit.
What
made you get him into this film?
I mean, it's interesting. I'm making a film about our elders. You know, my friend once, he said to me, Mike, you're making a film about old people, dementia, death, and nursing homes, my four least favorite subjects in the world. But I think Dr. Oliver Sacks is actually one of our elders. You know, he's one of the wise men, or, you know, wise people that we have, actually, that we trust. And this man has been so faithful for an entire career, just investigating the brain and its connection to music, and trying to, through examples of stories, you know, trying to tell us, show us, basically through stories, a different kind of reflection of who we are. You know, and I think he agrees with me that we are musical beings. We're vibratory creatures. And that's why I went to him, because I needed his authority. I needed him to tell me that what we were doing was real. And this is right down his alley. You know, he's been doing this for 50 years.
Bobby McFerrin.
If you're going to make a film about music that lives inside of the being, you know, who greater to tell the story, to bring out the truth that we are musical beings than Bobby McFerrin? He is a musical being. He doesn't have an instrument, you know. It's just all him. And I just love the sort of the symbolism of that, you mm-hmm. know.
Yeah, it was great. I really liked it. And you also brought, I mean, I'm just exploring the different elements, because you had the soundtracks from people's lives when you could get them
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
the things that the songs that they really loved.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had the Ugandan musician
right.
who didn't know what people liked, what kind of music they liked. I mean, the one woman who was she's schizophrenic.
Denise,
yeah,
yes, and schizophrenic bipolar.
Yeah, and when she was asked, what's your favorite music? And she got so wound up, and then she started shouting, Schubert, Schubert, which mm. was remarkable. And I'm sitting there listening. Then the next thing you see is she's listening to this Ugandan musician, and mm-hmm. she's just like totally absorbed by it.
You know? Right. Well, you know, one of the things that there's a parallel in the film between these people in these nursing homes, who've sometimes been there for almost a decade, right? And then these other people who have sort of suffered. Like, he went back to the Congo and he, you know, worked with these women, hundreds of women who had been raped and just suffering indignities to the human soul that are, for many people, destroy them. You know, just as these people were suffering a kind of indignity and they were losing their souls, you know, these Ugandan women had lost their souls. And Samate went to them, and he used his voice and the music. His music has a lineage of probably 10, 20, maybe 50, maybe 100,000 years. You know, he's a refugee from Uganda. So he lived in a village, in a small village, and that's where he learned how to make music. And the reason he's in the film is because by playing music that started these Congolese women, started their hearts moving again and their bodies moving again, they very simply came brought to tears. As they cried, they released this thing that they had been holding on to. When you are deeply abused, how do you create safety for yourself? You hold, you freeze, you know, and that's exactly what's happening in these nursing homes. You know, these people are suffering these indignities to the spirit. They're being treated like objects, and they're losing their souls. They're losing their selves, you know, and they retreat. And so then Samate went in, like, to Denise, and he used his voice as magic. That magic is just, it's just a spell. And he's saying what all music says, you know, that you are your heartbeat. You are a pulsatory being. You know what I mean? You are meant to vibrate with the world. And this is the exact opposite message that these people are getting every day. The message they're getting every day is, you are a thing. There's something wrong with you. If you don't behave, we're going to give you an antipsychotic medication. 20% of people in nursing homes are on antipsychotic medications. A study was just done at the Kohler-Goldwater nursing home in New York City, a huge, huge public nursing home. It is literally the biggest safety net nursing home left in the United States, public. They did a study over 3 years, and they gave people personalized music that from their youth, and it reduced the use of antipsychotic medication in the institution from 38% to 13%. Let's give these people a little bit of their soul back, okay? And then we don't have to drug them, because they're not going to go crazy. They're not going to act out. And an interesting thing about that was, on each of those patients that they got off of antipsychotics, The hospital, which is you and I, because it's a tax, it's funded by taxpayers, saved $400 per person per month.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Michael Rosato Bennett. And Michael is the director of the film Alive Inside, a brand new film about the impact of music on bringing those who are afflicted with dementia and many other illnesses back into the world, all right? Okay, you know, there's never a claim that this is curative.
No.
You know, but there's those moments when you look at, and you have a scene in there where you have all these people, and I've seen this, and I saw it only recently firsthand. Mm. My mother ended up in a nursing home. Mm. And she's in that stage of dementia where she'll be living in another world. She's talkative. She communicates mm-hmm. with people. But suddenly 1 week, maybe 3 weeks later, will come out and say, where am I? Am I living here? How long have I been away from home? What happened to my house? Mm. You know, and then she told my sister one time, she said, I'm so afraid that what if I go into this world and I never come out?
Oh.
But then she looks, and I look, and I saw these women who were sitting around her who were in the same wing as her. And there were so many who were sitting as I saw repeated in your film, people who were sitting with their heads bowed, with their head falling over on their shoulder, something propping them up in a wheelchair or on a couch or something.
Doesn't that hurt you?
Yeah.
Just even talk about it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But the thing is that while you said it wasn't curative, and Dan Cohen said it wasn't curative, at the same time, what people are handing out, which you make a really brilliant contrast with, is that the putting the antipsychotic medicines into the cup, and then this is what's going on in the vast majority. As I understand it, this is being used in 600 and some nursing homes.
Right, but there's 16,000
exactly.
nursing homes
exactly.
in the United States, and there's 35,000 assisted care places and something like 10,000 hospices. I mean, there's a lot of dying going on.
Right,
in our
country. that's what I was getting at, is because I kept watching this, and I have to tell you, folks, when you see this, It's an incredible thing happening here, where you see people who, I mean, I'm thinking of the woman you opened the film up with, who couldn't remember anything.
No.
she was suffering because she couldn't remember. She wasn't one of the people who was leaning all slumped over and all, but she couldn't remember anything. And you put on a soundtrack, you put on Louis Armstrong with singing When the Saints Come Marching In. Yeah. And she's all of a sudden, she's like, yeah, and she's singing, and then she starts talking. And then you get all these pictures, and she's talking about her when she was a child, and she's going through all this stuff, and it's incredible. You know, and you realize this thing of, you know, there's a point that I think, I don't remember whether it's made at the end of the film or it's made, somebody made it when, in relation to the film, but they said, as a result of all this, souls, hearts, and lives are receding when maybe they don't have to be.
Hmm.
And when you see that, it's very, very important, because they don't have to be.
Right. But that is the big aha. You know what I'm saying? Like you don't know how many people have come up to me and said, oh my God, you know, my dad, I watched my dad slip away in a nursing home for 2 or 3 years, and he was a classical pianist, and I'm a classical violinist, and I never thought to bring him his music. I never thought. Mm. When you enter into one of these facilities, you think this is the world. And I'm, you know, my stepfather just, we had him in a nursing home, like when I was in the middle of this film. And I was utterly helpless. This filmmaker who supposedly, you know, has all this knowledge, I was literally helpless. I didn't know how to help him on my own. Luckily, we got him out. He didn't even need to be there in the end. It was just a condition that we could fix. And when we fixed it, his mind came back, you know. But he had a family. 50% of people in nursing homes get no visitors. If we had abandoned my stepfather, right, if we had just left him, his life would have ended right there. Okay, we were persistent and we stuck with it. And we said, like, what is it? What's going on? You know, this whole idea that it doesn't have to be like this is a consciousness shift.
In the film, someone made the comment where they said they were describing, and you talked about this a little bit earlier, they were describing that a lot of times it's not the disease that actually has people withdraw, but people, their inability, whatever problems they're having themselves physically and mentally, and then they're trying to interact and they're trying to have some kind of connection, but it can't be made. So they withdraw into themselves and they go
exactly.
into this.
I mean, just you want to give a parallel to your own life. You know, I mean, I'm sure many of us have struggled with depression, right? And, you know, you get depressed. And when you're depressed, you feel like there is just no way out and this is life forever. Well, if you're my age and you've been through a lot, you've actually kind of learned how to deal with that. I know it doesn't have to be like that. It may be hard. But and I'm in the past, I couldn't make those choices, but now I have the strength to do that. And it's the same thing with these people. Their lives don't have to be like that. They don't know it. Their lives don't have to be like that. The caregivers don't know it. Their life doesn't have to be like that. The institution doesn't know that, you know? And well, all we did was we came in to this desert of Saul and we brought a simple little gift. We brought them the music that they'd loved when they were young. And that's it. And there's this miracle that the emotional system in Alzheimer's patients is still alive, and that music can stir emotion, and that emotion can actually create brain functionality. Okay, so this is the miracle. But then when they bloomed, when they came back to life, no, it's not forever, right? But did we learn what we should have learned from that? You know, did we look at them and go, oh, there's life in these people? You know, or do we just go, oh, that was a bloom. Sorry, it doesn't fit in the institutional model. Let them bloom for a minute and then put them back on antipsychotics. You know?
No. It really does have to do with the whole character of the society in general.
Thank you.
And, you know, the way that the things get so distorted. And if you're not useful to this system, then you're tossed aside.
What do you think of that? Is that true? Is that real?
What's real? I think it's real in the system that they do this. But for me, look, I think that people, no matter what, that we need to find the ways for people to constantly maintain a connection with each other all across society.
That's it.
And to actually be able to contribute in whatever way they can to this. I mean, I'm thinking about this guy, Henry, featured in the beginning of the film. We had talked about him. He was bent over and he was the Cab Calloway guy, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah. Who had been a singer and a dancer when he was a kid.
Just for fun.
Yeah, yeah, right. But he was, as he was leaned over and suddenly put those headphones on him and he wakes up and his eyes are so alive and he starts moving and then he starts singing and then you see him throughout the whole film doing this. And then I read that the man was like that for 4 years. Now, it wasn't probably constant, but he had that period of time for 4 more years.
Right, right.
Where he could actually be in the world and be with people, and people could be with him.
Yeah, it's amazing.
You know, it was like just a whole different thing going on. And to me, I value that tremendously. Mm. That's what I would say.
That's why a film like this has deeper repercussions, because the questions it raises are, you know, what do we think is human life? And for me, the lesson for me is that is the power of connection. And I look around my culture and I see that we don't value connection. We worship the individual, the idea that we are actual individuals. And if you study music and the effects of music on the body, on the mind, on interpersonal exchange, we are not individuals. And that is so counter to the world that we're living in today. We seem to have a conspiracy of individuality.
You know, there's individuality, which I think is actually important. People are different. Each one of us are different. And we bring things to our relations with each other somewhat based on
individuality. You just said we bring things to our relations with each other.
Yeah, right. But then there's individualism, which is a whole other ballgame. This is part of the problem, I think. And what I think, actually, just as we're moving to wrap this up, I really think that when I was talking about why do I think this is, what's important about people breaking out of this and being able to, you know, reconnect with humanity, and then why does it happen? As brilliant as your film is, and as important as this effort is, okay, there's still, in the overall society, and that's why when you think about it, it gets me so angry when we talk about 650 nursing homes and all these people, millions of people living in all these other situations, and they can't get out of it. And right. It's because the society not only doesn't value, but discards.
Well, you know,
they can't be used anymore.
Look, I don't know how I'm going to do this. Come to aliveinside.us. That's my website. I am going to create a movement. I'm going to bring young people, and I'm going to teach them about connection to themselves. And, you know, and I'm going to take them into nursing homes and have them find music for elders. And so they're going to get to see another human being wake up. They're going to get to see their efforts give a gift to somebody that will be with them for the rest of their life, you know. And they'll hear music that is so wise and so beautiful and that they will never have an opportunity to hear in their American childhood, you know. So this is part of my journey, and I'm looking forward to trying it.
All right, Michael, thank you very much for joining us today. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Michael Rosato Bennett about his film Alive Inside. And don't miss this film. Do what you got to do to see it. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be listening to a brief message from Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper and for StopPatriarchy.org, and she's also part of End Pornography and Patriarchy, the Enslavement and Degradation of Women. And Sansara is going to be talking about the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, which is kicking off in Texas as we speak now, all right? And we're going to be hearing from Sansara over the next few weeks to give us regular reports on what's going on in the sharpest front against the war on women today. So don't miss this. All right, welcome back. That was Bikini Kill with Rebel Girl, all right? And it's one of my favorite songs and also one that's so damn fitting right now. Coming up, we're going to be listening to an announcement from Sansara Taylor from Revolution Newspaper, StopPatriarchy.org, and End Pornography and Patriarchy, the Enslavement and Degradation of Women. Now, Sansara is going to be announcing, the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, which is happening at Ground Zero in the fight against the oppression of women right now. And that's deep down in Texas. That's right, Texas. The same place where you got Rick Perry and all those yahoos and all that stuff going on. Well, that's Ground Zero for the war on women. And Sansara is actually calling for people to come up and join the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride. And we're going to be listening to Sansara every week for the next few weeks as she gives us a report about what's happening in this ongoing battle, all right? So stay tuned for that. But right now, listen close as Sansara makes her announcement about the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride happening in Texas as you're listening.
My name is Sansara Taylor. Every day we're bombarded with the message that to be happy or to have meaning, you have to buy this or that product, or you have to bow down to this or that god, or you have to get ahead, most often by beating out or beating down somebody else. But that's not true. That's just the way this system wants us to think. And it's a big part of what keeps this world going the way it is, with all the nightmare that this means for humanity. Think just about what women face. Across this planet, women are treated like punching bags. Women are raped and gang raped. They're forced under the veil, they're pimped out, they're forced to have children against their will, and they're degraded and insulted and disrespected in countless ways. Right here in this country, there's an all-out assault on women's basic right to abortion and birth control. This is a war to force women back to the days of the back alleys of illegal abortions and thousands of deaths, to the days of forced motherhood and female enslavement, where literally millions of women had their lives foreclosed. We must not go back to that. We should not put up with any of this. We don't have to put up with any of this, but if we're going to stop this, you have to be part of fighting it. Anybody who thought the Supreme Court was going to protect the rights of women got a sober wake-up call the other day with the Hobby Lobby ruling that not only deprives thousands of women access to birth control, it opens the floodgates to all kinds of religious bigotry and theocracy to be imposed throughout society. No. If we're going to defeat this war on women, it's going to take all of us stepping up and stepping out of our comfort zone, drawing a line and fighting. And right now, the battle lines are drawn sharpest in Texas. It's a concentration of what's happening nationwide. 2 years ago, there was 46 abortion clinics in Texas. By September, there'll only be 6 of them left. There's a trial on August 4th to determine if these closures are going to go forward. We have to create a political situation where the courts realize they can't get away with closing any more clinics, where their whole political calculation changes because people are putting themselves in the line to say we refuse to accept this. That's why I'm part of the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, and I'm calling on you to join me by going down to Texas this August and being part of turning the tide. If you're in Texas, join with the Freedom Ride. Open your homes to the volunteers. Join us in the streets. Across the country, tune in. Every Wednesday night, we're going to hold people's hearings that bring alive what it really means to real women's lives that these clinics are being closed and what it was like before Roe v. Wade, because most people don't understand the true stakes of this fight. Send in your own testimony from across the country, your stories of pre-Roe abortions or of what you've gone through today. Be part of building this struggle anywhere you are and in every way you can. We need filmmakers, we need artists, we need singers and songwriters, we need people on the phone. We need everybody to make a donation to make sure that this ride is as powerful as it can be. Everybody can do something. Everybody has a responsibility. So my challenge is to you, at this time of unprecedented danger to women's lives everywhere, including in this country, don't turn your head. Do something that truly has meaning. Do something that will truly bring joy, not just to you, but to women everywhere and to future generations. Be part of standing up to turn the tide, to defeat this war on women, and to make a great advance in fighting to win the emancipation of humanity and the full liberation of women. Join with me this summer in the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride.
All right, welcome back. That was Sansara Taylor from Revolution Newspaper and StopPatriarchy.org. And she was making an announcement about the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride that's happening as you're listening to this down in Texas right now. Texas is ground zero in the ongoing and intensifying war on women, particularly on the front of the assaults on abortion rights. And the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride is gathering women and others from all over the country to stand up against this. And if you're out there and you want to find out more about it, go to stoppatriarchy.org, figure out how you can sign up, figure out how you can spread the word, all right? You can also go to revcom.us and find out about it there as well. All right, well, that just about wraps up our show for today. And as we get ready to go out, I want to read to you something that's very appropriate for what we've just heard from Sansara Taylor. It's from Bob Avakian, and you can find it in his book Basics, all right? And listen to this. You cannot break all the chains except one. You cannot say you want to be free of exploitation and oppression, except you want to keep the oppression of women by men. You can't say you want to liberate humanity, yet keep one half of the people enslaved to the other half. The oppression of women is completely bound up with the division of society into masters and slaves, exploiters and exploited, and the ending of all such conditions is impossible without the complete liberation of women. All this is why women have a tremendous role to play, not only in making revolution, but in making sure there is all the way revolution. The fury of women can and must be fully unleashed as a mighty force for proletarian revolution. Again, that's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and you can find it in his book Basics, and you can find out more about Avakian's work by going to the site revcom.us, all right? So definitely check that out. Okay, I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my board offer today, Teddy Robinson, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. All right, and we're going to go out now with a song that really I think is an extremely important song. It's a brand new album from Chucky Weiss, okay? And it's a song called Bomb the Tracks, and it's all about what kind of stand do people have to take in a world as screwed up as the one we have today is, all right? So check this out.
Such a mystery to me. Oh, you didn't care.